refusing to say if he believed in any of them, and Roland thought it was tangential to one of these lessons that Vene had mentioned Todash. Oh, perhaps you capitalized it. Perhaps it was Todash. Roland didn't know for sure. He knew that Vene had spoken of the Mani sect, people who were far travelers, and hadn't he also mentioned the Wizard's Rainbow? Roland thought yes, but he had twice had the pink Bend of the Rainbow in his own possession, once as a boy and once as a man. And although he had traveled in it both times, with his friends on the second occasion, it had never taken him Todash. "Ah, but how would you know?" he asked himself. "How would you know, Roland, when you were inside it?" Because Cuthbert and Alain would have told him that was why. "Are you sure?" Some feeling, so strange as to be unidentifiable, rose in the gunslinger's bosom. Was it indignation? Horror? Perhaps even a sense of betrayal? As he realized that, no, he wasn't sure. All he knew was that the ball had taken him deep into itself, and he had been lucky to ever get out again. "There's no ball here," he thought. And again it was that other voice, the dry, implacable voice of his old, limping tutor, whose grief for his only son had never really ended, that answered him, and the words were the same. "Are you sure? Gunslinger, are you sure?" 6. It started with a low, crackling sound. Roland's first thought was the campfire. One of them had gotten some green fir boughs in there. The coals had finally reached them, and they were producing that sound as the needles smoldered. But the sound grew louder, became a kind of electric buzzing. Roland sat up and looked across the dying fire. His eyes widened, and his heart began to speed up. Susanna had turned from Eddie, had drawn away a little too. Eddie had reached out, and so had Jake. Their hands touched. And as Roland looked at them, they commenced fading in and out of existence in a series of jerky pulses. Oi was doing the same thing. When they were gone, they were replaced by a dull gray glow that approximated the shapes and positions of their bodies, as if something was holding their places in reality. Each time they came back, it would be that crackling buzz. Roland could see their closed eyelids ripple as the balls rolled beneath. Dreaming, but not just dreaming. This was Todash, the passing between two worlds. Supposedly, the Mani could do it. And supposedly, some pieces of the Wizard's Rainbow could make you do it, whether you wanted to or not. One piece of it in particular. They could get caught between and fall, Roland thought. Vane said that, too. He said that going Todash was full of peril. What else had he said? Roland had no time to recall, for at that moment Susanna sat up, slipped the soft leather caps Roland had made her over the stumps of her legs, then hoisted herself into her wheelchair. A moment later she was rolling toward the ancient trees on the north side of the road. It was directly away from the place where the watchers were camped. There was that much to be grateful for. Roland stayed where he was for a moment, torn. But in the end, his course was clear enough. He couldn't wake them up while they were in the Todash state. To do so would be a horrible risk. All he could do was follow Susanna, as he had on other nights, and hope she didn't get herself into trouble. "You might also do some thinking about what happens next." That was Vane's dry, lecturely voice. Now that his old tutor was back, he apparently meant to stay for a while. "Reason was never your strong point, but you must do it nevertheless. You'll want to wait until your visitors make themselves known, of course, until you can be sure of what they want. But eventually, Roland, you must act. Think first, however. Sooner would be better than later." Yes, sooner was always better than later. There was another loud, buzzing crackle. Eddie and Jake were back. Jake lying with his arm curled around Oi, and then they were gone again, nothing left where they had been but a faint ectoplasmic shimmer. Well, never mind. His job was to follow Susanna. As for Eddie and Jake, there would be water if God willed it. Suppose you come back here and they're gone. It happens, Vanay said so. What will you tell her if she wakes and finds them both gone, her husband and her adopted son? It was nothing he could worry about now. Right now, there was Susanna to worry about. Susanna to keep safe. 7. On the north side of the road, old trees with enormous trunks stood at considerable distances from each other. Their branches might entwine and create a solid canopy overhead, but at ground level there was plenty of room for Susanna's wheelchair, and she moved along at a good pace, weaving between the vast ironwoods and pines, rolling downhill over a fragrant duff of mulch and needles. Not Susanna. Not Detta or Odetta either. This one calls herself Mia. Roland didn't care if she called herself Queen of Green Days, as long as she came back safe. And the other two were still there when she did. He began to smell a brighter, fresher green, reeds and water weeds. With it came the smell of mud, the thump of frogs, the sarcastic hool-hool salute of an owl, the splash of water as something jumped. This was followed by a thin shriek as something died, maybe the jumper, maybe the jumped upon. Underbrush began to spring up in the duff, first dotting it and then crowding it out. The tree cover thinned. Mosquitoes and chiggers whined. Binny bugs stitched the air. The bog smells grew stronger. The wheels of the chair had passed over the duff without leaving any trace. As duff gave way to straggling low growth, Roland began to see broken twigs and torn-off leaves marking her passage. Then, as she reached the more or less level low ground, the wheels began to sink into the increasingly soft earth. 20 paces farther on, he began to see liquid seeping into the tracks. She was too wise to get stuck, though, too crafty. 20 paces beyond the first signs of seepage, he came to the wheelchair itself. Abandoned. Lying on the seat were her pants and shirt. She had gone on into the bog naked, save for the leather caps that covered her stumps. Down here, there were ribbons of mist hanging over puddles of standing water. Grassy hummocks rose. On one, wired to a dead log that had been planted upright, was what Roland at first took for an ancient stuffy guy. When he got closer, he saw it was a human skeleton. The skull's forehead had been smashed inward, leaving a triangle of darkness between the staring sockets. Some sort of primitive war club had made that wound, no doubt, and the corpse, or its lingering spirit, had been left to mark this as the edge of some tribe's territory. They were probably long dead or moved on, but caution was ever a virtue. Roland drew his gun and continued after the woman, stepping from hummock to hummock, wincing at the occasional jab of pain in his right hip. It took all his concentration and agility to keep up with her. Partly this was because she hadn't Roland's interest in staying as dry as possible. She was as naked as a mermaid and moved like one, as comfortable in the muck and swamp ooze as on dry land. She crawled over the larger hummocks, slid through the water between them, pausing every now and then to pick off a leech. In the darkness, the walking and sliding seemed to merge into a single slithering motion that was eerie and disturbing. She went on perhaps a quarter of a mile into the increasingly oozy bog, with the gunslinger following patiently along behind her. He kept as quiet as possible, although he doubted if there was any need. The part of her that saw and felt and thought was far from here. At last she came to a halt, standing on her truncated legs and holding to tough tangles of brush on either side in order to keep her balance. She looked out over the black surface of a pond, head up, body still. The gunslinger couldn't tell if the pond was big or small. Its borders were lost in the mist. Yet there was light here, some sort of faint and unfocused radiance, which seemed to lie just beneath the surface of the water itself, perhaps emanating from submerged and slowly rotting logs. She stood there, surveying this muck-crusted woodland pond like a queen surveying a what? What did she see? A banquet hall? That was what he had come to believe, almost to see. It was a whisper from her mind to his, and it dovetailed with what she said and did. The banqueting hall was her mind's ingenious way of keeping Susanna apart from Mia, as it had kept Odetta apart from Detta all those years. Mia might have any number of reasons for wanting to keep her existence a secret, but surely the greatest of these had to do with the life she carried inside her. The chap, she called it. Then, with a suddenness that still startled him, although he had seen this before as well, she began to hunt, slipping in eerie, splashless silence, first along the edge of the pond and then a little way out into it. Roland watched her with an expression that contained both horror and lust as she knitted and wove her way in and out of the reeds, between and over the tussocks. Now, instead of picking the leeches off her skin and throwing them away, she tossed them into her mouth, like pieces of candy. The muscles in her thighs rippled. Her brown skin gleamed like wet silk. When she turned, Roland had by this time stepped behind a tree and become one of the shadows, he could clearly see the way her breasts had ripened. The problem, of course, extended beyond the chap. There was Eddie to consider as well. "What the hell's wrong with you, Roland?" Roland could hear him saying. "That might be our kid. I mean, you can't know for sure that it isn't." Yeah, I know something had her while we were yanking Jake through, but that doesn't necessarily mean..." On and on and on, blah, 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 as Eddie himself might say. And why? Because he loved her and would want the child of their union. And because arguing came as naturally to Eddie Dean as breathing. Cuthbert had been the same. In the reeds, the naked woman's hand pistoned forward and seized a good-sized frog. She squeezed, and the frog popped, squirting guts and a shiny load of eggs between her fingers. Its head burst. She lifted it to her mouth and ate it greedily down while its greenish-white rear legs still twitched, licking the blood and shiny ropes of tissue from her knuckles. Then she mimed throwing something down and cried out, "How you like that, you stinking blue lady?" in a low, guttural voice that made Roland shiver. It was Detta Walker's voice. Detta at her meanest and craziest. With hardly a pause, she moved on again, questing. Next, it was a small fish, then another frog, and then a real prize, a water rat that squeaked and writhed and tried to bite. She crushed the life out of it and stuffed it into her mouth, paws and all. A moment later, she bent her head down and regurgitated the waste, a twisted mass of fur and splintered bones. "Show him this, then." Always assuming that he and Jake get back from whatever adventure they're on, that is, and say, "I know that women are supposed to have strange cravings when they carry a child, Eddie, but doesn't this seem a little too strange? Look at her, questing through the reeds and ooze like some sort of human alligator. Look at her and tell me she's doing that in order to feed your child. Any human child." Still, he would argue. Roland knew it. What he didn't know was what Susanna herself might do when Roland told her she was growing something that craved raw meat in the middle of the night. And as if this business wasn't worrisome enough, now there was Todash, and strangers who had come looking for them. Yet the strangers were the least of his problems. In fact, he found their presence almost comforting. He didn't know what they wanted, and yet he did know. He had met them before, many times. At bottom, they always wanted the same thing. 8. Now the woman who called herself Mia began to talk as she hunted. Roland was familiar with this part of her ritual as well, but it chilled him nevertheless. He was looking right at her, and it was still hard to believe all those different voices could be coming from the same throat. She asked herself how she was. She told herself she was doing fine, thank you so very much. She spoke of someone named Bill, or perhaps it was Bull. She asked after someone's mother. She asked someone about a place called Morehouse. And then, in a deep, gravelly voice, a man's voice, beyond doubt, she told herself that she didn't go to Morehouse or no house. She laughed raucously at this, so it must have been some sort of joke. She introduced herself several times, as she had on other nights, as Mia, a name Roland knew well from his early life in Gilead. It was almost a holy name. Twice she curtsied, lifting invisible skirts in a way that tugged at the gunslinger's heart. He had first seen that sort of curtsy in Magus when he and his friends, Alan and Cuthbert, had been sent there by their fathers. She worked her way back to the edge of the hall, pond, glistening and wet. She stayed there without moving for 5 minutes, then 10. The owl uttered its derisive salute again, whoo, and as if in response, the moon came out of the clouds for a brief look around. When it did, some small animal's bit of shady concealment disappeared. It tried to dart past the woman. She snared it faultlessly and plunged her face into its writhing belly. There was a wet, crunching noise, followed by several smacking bites. She held the remains up in the moonlight, her dark hands and wrists darker with its blood. Then she tore it in half and bolted down the remains. She gave a resounding belch and rolled herself back into the water. This time she made a great splash, and Roland knew tonight's banqueting was done. She had even eaten some of the binny bugs, snatching them effortlessly out of the air. He could only hope nothing she'd taken in would sicken her. So far, nothing had. While she made her rough toilet, washing off the mud and blood, Roland retreated back the way he'd come, ignoring the more frequent pains in his hip and moving with all his guile. He had watched her go through this 3 times before, and once had been enough to see how gruesomely sharp her senses were while in this state. He paused at her wheelchair, looking around to make sure he'd left no trace of himself. He saw a boot print, smoothed it away, then tossed a few leaves over it for good measure. Not too many. Too many might be worse than none at all. With that done, he headed back toward the road and their camp, not hurrying anymore. She would pause for a little housekeeping of her own before going on. What would Mia see as she was cleaning Susanna's wheelchair, he wondered? Some sort of small motorized cart? It didn't matter. What did was how clever she was. If he hadn't awakened with a need to make water just as she left on one of her earlier expeditions, he quite likely still wouldn't know about her hunting trips, and he was supposed to be clever about such things. Not as clever as she, maggot. Now, as if the ghost of Vanay were not enough, here was Court to lecture him. She's shown you before, hasn't she? Yes. She had shown him cleverness as 3 women. Now there was this 4th. 9. When Roland saw the break in the trees ahead, the road they'd been following and the place where they'd camped for the night, he took 2 long, deep breaths. These were meant to steady him and didn't succeed very well. Water, if God wills it, he reminded himself. About the great matters, Roland, you have no say. Not a comfortable truth, especially for a man on a quest such as his, but one he'd learned to live with. He took another breath and stepped out. He released the air in a long, relieved sigh as he saw Eddie and Jake lying deeply asleep beside the dead fire. Jake's right hand, which had been linked with Eddie's left when the gunslinger had followed Susanna out of camp, now circled Oi's body. The bumbler opened one eye and regarded Roland. Then he closed it again. Roland couldn't hear her coming, but sensed her just the same. He lay down quickly, rolled over onto his side, and put his face in the crook of his elbow. And from this position, he watched as the wheelchair rolled out of the trees. She had cleaned it quickly, but well. Roland couldn't see a single spot of mud. The spokes gleamed in the moonlight. She parked the chair where it had been before, slipped out of it with her usual grace, and moved across to where Eddie lay. Roland watched her approach her husband's sleeping form with some anxiety. Anyone, he thought, who had met Detta Walker would have felt that anxiety, because the woman who called herself mother was simply too close to what Detta had been. Lying completely still, like one in sleep's deepest sling, Roland prepared himself to move. Then she brushed the hair back from the side of Eddie's face and kissed the hollow of his temple. The tenderness in that gesture told the gunslinger all he needed to know. It was safe to sleep. He closed his eyes and let the darkness take him. Chapter 4 Palaver 1 When Roland woke in the morning, Susanna was still asleep, but Eddie and Jake were up. Eddie had built a small new fire on the gray bones of the old one. He and the boys sat close to it for the warmth, eating what Eddie called gunslinger burritos. They looked both excited and worried. Roland, Eddie said, I think we need to talk. Something happened to us last night. I know, Roland said. I saw. You went Todash.
Todash?
Jake asked. What's that? Roland started to tell them, then shook his head. If we're going to palaver, Eddie, you'd better wake Susanna up. That way, we won't have to double back over the first part. He glanced south. And hopefully our new friends won't interrupt us until we've had our talk. They're none of this. But already he was wondering about that. He watched with more than ordinary interest as Eddie shook Susanna awake, quite sure but by no means positive that it would be Susanna who opened her eyes. It was. She sat up, stretched, ran her fingers through her tight curls.
What's your problem, honey child? I was good for another hour at least.
We need to talk, Suze, Eddie said.
Oh, you what, but not quite yet, she said. God, but I'm stiff.
Sleeping on hard ground will do it every time, Eddie said.
Not to mention hunting, naked, in the bogs and damps, Roland thought.
Pour me some water, Shug.
She held out her palms, and Eddie filled them with water from one of the skins. She dashed this over her cheeks and into her eyes, gave out a little shivery cry, and said, Cold.
Old,
Oi said.
Not yet, she told the bumbler, but you give me a few more months like the last few and I will be.
Roland, you mid-world folks know about coffee, right?
Roland nodded. From the plantations of the Outer Ark, down south.
If we come across some, we'll hook it, won't we? You promise me now.
I promise, Roland said. Susanna, meanwhile, was studying Eddie.
What's going on? You boys don't look so good.
More dreams, Eddie said.
Me too, Jake said.
Not dreams, the gunslinger said. Susanna, how did you sleep? She looked at him candidly. Roland did not sense even the shadow of a lie in her answer.
Like a rock, as I usually do.
One thing all this traveling is good for, you can throw your damn Nembutal away.
What's this toadish thing, Roland? Eddie asked.
Todash, he said, and explained it to them as well as he could. What he remembered best from Vanay's teachings was how the Mani spent long periods fasting in order to induce the right state of mind, and how they traveled around looking for exactly the right spot in which to induce the Todash state. This was something they determined with magnets and large plumb bobs.
Sounds to me like these guys would have been right at home down in Needle Park, Eddie said.
Anywhere in Greenwich Village, Susanna added.
Sounds Hawaiian, doesn't it?
Jake said in a grave, deep voice, and they all laughed. Even Roland laughed a little.
Todash is another way of traveling, Eddie said when the laughter had stopped. Like the doors and the glass balls, is that right?
Roland started to say yes, then hesitated. I think they might all be variations of the same thing, he said. And according to Vanay, the glass balls, the pieces of the wizard's rainbow, make going Todash easier. Sometimes too easy.
Jake said, We really flickered on and off like light bulbs, which you call spark lights?
Yes. You appeared and disappeared. When you were gone, there was a dim glow where you'd been, almost as if something were holding your place for you.
Thank God if it was, Eddie said. When it ended, when those chimes started playing again and we kicked loose, I'll tell you the truth, I didn't think we were going to get back.
Neither did I, Jake said quietly.
The sky had clouded over again, and in the dull morning light, the boy looked very pale.
I lost you.
I was never so glad to see any place in my life as I was when I opened my eyes and saw this little piece of road, Eddie said. And you beside me, Jake. Even Rover looked good to me.
He glanced at Oi, then over at Susanna.
Nothing like this happened to you last night, hon?
We'd have seen her, Jake said.
Not if she toe-dashed off to someplace else, Eddie said.
Susanna shook her head, looking troubled.
I just slept the night away, as I told you. What about you, Roland?
Nothing to report, Roland said. As always, he would keep his own counsel, until his instinct told him it was time to share. And besides, what he'd said wasn't exactly a lie. He looked keenly at Eddie and Jake.
There's trouble, isn't there? Eddie and Jake looked at each other, then back at Roland.
Eddie sighed.
Yeah, probably.
How bad, do you know?
I don't think we do. Do we, Jake?
Jake shook his head.
But I've got some ideas, Eddie went on, and if I'm right, we've got a problem, a big one.
He swallowed, hard. Jake touched his hand, and the gunslinger was concerned to see how quickly and firmly Eddie took hold of the boy's fingers. Roland reached out and drew Susanna's hand into his own. He had a brief vision of that hand seizing a frog and squeezing the guts out of it. He put it out of his mind. The woman who had done that was not here now.
Tell us, he said to Eddie and Jake, tell us everything. We would hear it all.
Every word, Susanna agreed, for your father's sakes.
2. They recounted what had happened to them in the New York of 1977. Roland and Susanna listened, fascinated, as they told of following Jake to the bookstore and of seeing Balazar and his gentleman pull up in front.
Huh, Susanna said. The very same bad boys. It's almost like a Dickens novel.
Who is Dickens? And what is a novel? Roland asked.
A novel's a long story set down in a book, she said. Dickens wrote about a dozen. He was maybe the best who ever lived. In his stories, folks in this big city called London kept meeting people they knew from other places or long ago. I had a teacher in college who hated the way that always happened. He said Dickens's stories were full of easy coincidences.
A teacher who either didn't know about Ka or didn't believe in it, Roland said.
Eddie was nodding. Yeah, this is Ka, all right. No doubt.
I'm more interested in the woman who wrote Charlie the Choo-Choo than this storyteller Dickens, Roland said.
Jake, I wonder if you'd...
I'm way ahead of you,
Jake said, unbuckling the straps of his pack. Almost reverently, he slid out the battered book telling the adventures of Charlie the Locomotive and his friend, Engineer Bob. They all looked at the cover. The name below the picture was still Beryl Evans.
Man, Eddie said, that is so weird. I mean... I don't want to get sidetracked or anything.
He paused, realizing he had just made a railroading pun, then went on. Roland wasn't very interested in puns and jokes anyway.
But that is weird. The one Jake bought, Jake 77, was by Claudia something Bachman.
Inez, Jake said. Also, there was a Y, a lowercase y. Any of you know what that means?
None of them did, but Roland said there had been names like it in Mages.
I believe it was some sort of added honorific. And I'm not sure it is to the side.
Jake, you said the sign in the window was different from before.
How?
I can't remember, but you know what? I think if you hypnotized me again, you know, with the bullet, I could.
And in time I may, Roland said. But this morning, time is short.
Back to that again, Eddie thought. Yesterday it hardly existed, and now it's short. But it's all about time somehow, isn't it? Roland's old days, our old days, and these new days? These dangerous new days?
Why? Susanna asked.
Our friends, Roland said, and nodded to the south. I have a feeling they'll be making themselves known to us soon.
Are they our friends?
Jake asked. That really is to the side, Roland said, and again wondered if that were really true. For now, let's turn the mind of our Kef to this bookstore of the mind, or whatever it's called. You saw the Harriers from the Leaning Tower greensticking the owner, didn't you? This man Tower, or Torin.
Pressuring him, you mean? Eddie asked. Twisting his arm?
Yes.
Sure they were,
Jake said.
Where?
Oi put in.
Sure were.
Bet you anything that Tower and Torin are really the same name, Susanna said. That Torin's Dutch for Tower.
She saw Roland getting ready to speak and held up her hand.
It's the way folks often do things in our bit of the universe, Roland. Change the foreign name to one that's more, well, American.
Yeah, Eddie said. So Stemperwitz becomes Stamper, Yakov becomes Jacob, or...
Or Beryl Evans becomes Claudia E. Inez Backman, Jake said.
He laughed, but didn't sound very amused.
Eddie picked a half-burned stick out of the fire and began to doodle with it in the dirt. One by one, the great letters formed. C. L. A. U.
Big Nose even said Tower was Dutch. A squarehead's always a squarehead, right, boss?
He looked at Jake for confirmation. Jake nodded, then took the stick and continued on with it. D. I. A.
Him being Dutch makes a lot of sense, you know, Susanna said. At one time, the Dutch owned most of Manhattan.
You want another Dickens touch? Jake asked.
He wrote Y in the dirt after Claudia, then looked up at Susanna.
How about the haunted house where I came through into this world?
The mansion, Eddie said.
The mansion in Dutch Hill, Jake said.
Dutch Hill, yeah, that's right. God damn.
Let's go to the core, Roland said. I think it's the agreement paper you saw, and you felt you had to see it, didn't you?
Eddie nodded.
Did your need feel like a part of following the beam?
Roland, I think it was the beam.
The way to the tower, in other words.
Yeah, Eddie said.
He was thinking about the way clouds flowed along the beam, the way shadows bent along the beam, the way every twig of every tree seemed to turn in its direction.
All things serve the beam, Roland had told him, and Eddie's need to see the paper Balazar had put in front of Calvin Tower had felt like a need, harsh and imperative.
Tell me what it said.
Eddie bit his lip. He didn't feel as scared about this as he had about carving the key, which had ultimately allowed them to rescue Jake and pull him through to this side, but it was close. Because like the key, this was important. If he forgot something, worlds might crash.
Man, I can't remember it all, not word for word.
Roland made an impatient gesture. If I need that, I'll hypnotize you and get it word for word.
Do you think it matters? Susanna asked.
I think it all matters, Roland said.
What if hypnosis doesn't work on me? Eddie asked. What if I'm not, like, a good subject?
Leave that to me, Roland said.
19, Jake said abruptly. They all turned toward him. He was looking at the letters he and Eddie had drawn in the dirt beside the dead campfire.
Claudia E. Inez Backman. 19 letters.
3. Roland considered for a moment, then let it pass. If the number 19 was somehow part of this, its meaning would declare itself in time. For now, there were other matters.
The paper, he said. Let's stay with that for now. Tell me everything about it you can remember.
Well, it was a legal agreement, with the seal at the bottom and everything.
Eddie paused, struck by a fairly basic question. Roland probably got this part of it. He'd been a kind of law enforcement officer after all, but it wouldn't hurt to be sure.
You know about lawyers, don't you?
Roland spoke in his driest tone.
You forget that I came from Gilead, Eddie. The most inner of the inner baronies. We had more merchants and farmers and manufacturers than lawyers, I think, but the count would have been close.
Susanna laughed.
You make me think of a scene from Shakespeare, Roland. Two characters, might have been Falstaff and Prince Hal, I'm not sure, are talking about what they're going to do when they win the war and take over, and one of them says, first we'll kill all the lawyers.
It would be a fairish way to start, Roland said. And Eddie found his thoughtful tone rather chilling.
Then the gunslinger turned to him again. Go on. If you can add anything, Jake, please do, and relax, both of you, for your father's sakes. For now, I only want a sketch.
Eddie supposed he'd known that, but hearing Roland say it made him feel better.
All right. It was a memorandum of agreement. That was right at the top in big letters. At the bottom it said agreed to, and there were two signatures. One was Calvin Tower, the other was Richard someone. Do you remember, Jake?
Sayre, Jake said. Richard Patrick Sayre.
He paused briefly, lips moving, then nodded.
19 letters.
And what did it say, this agreement? Roland asked.
Not all that much, if you want to know the truth, Eddie said. Or that's what it seemed like to me, anyway. Basically, it said that Tower owned a vacant lot on the corner of 46th Street and 2nd Avenue.
The vacant lot, Jake said. The one with the rose in it. Yeah, that one. Anyway, Towers signed this agreement on July 15th, 1976. Sombra Corporation gave him $100,000. What he gave them, so far as I could tell, was a promise not to sell the lot to anyone but Sombra for the next year, to take care of it, pay the taxes and such, and then to give Sombra first right of purchase, assuming he hasn't sold it to them by then anyway. Which he hadn't when we were there, but the agreement still had a month and a half to run.
Mr. Towers said the $100,000 was all spent, Jake put in.
Was there anything in the agreement about this Sombra Corporation having a topping privilege? Susanna asked. Eddie and Jake thought it over, exchanged a glance, then shook their heads.
Sure?
Susanna asked.
Not quite, but pretty sure, Eddie said.
You think it matters?
I don't know, Susanna said. The kind of agreement you're talking about, well, without a topping privilege, it just doesn't seem to make sense.
What does it boil down to when you stop to think about it? I, Calvin Tower, agree to think about selling you my vacant lot. You pay me $100,000, and I'll think about it for a whole year. When I'm not drinking coffee and playing chess with my friends, that is, and when the year's up, maybe I'll sell it to you, and maybe I'll keep it, and maybe I'll just auction it off to the highest bidder. And if you don't like it, sweet cheeks, you just go spit.
You're forgetting something, Roland said mildly.
What? Susanna asked.
This Sombra is no ordinary law-abiding combination. Ask yourself if an ordinary law-abiding combination would hire someone like Balazar to carry their messages.
You have a point, Eddie said. Tower was mucho scared.
Anyway, Jake said, it makes at least a few things clearer. The sign I saw in the vacant lot, for instance. This Sombra company also got the right to advertise forthcoming projects there for their $100,000. Did you see that part, Eddie?
I think so, right after the part about Tower not permitting any liens or encumbrances on his property because of Sombra's stated interest, wasn't it?
Right, Jake said. The sign I saw in the lot said...
He paused, thinking, then raised his hands and looked between them as if reading a sign only he could see. Mills Construction and Sombra Real Estate Associates are continuing to remake the face of Manhattan, and then, coming soon, Turtle Bay Luxury Condominiums.
So that's what they want it for, Eddie said. Condos, but
what are condominiums? Susanna asked, frowning. It sounds like some newfangled kind of spice rack.
It's a kind of co-op apartment deal, Eddie said. They probably had them in your Wen, but by a different name.
Yeah, Susanna said with some asperity, we called them co-ops. Or sometimes we went way downtown and called them apartment buildings.
It doesn't matter because it was never about condos, Jake said. Never about the building the sign said they were going to put there, for that matter. All that's only, you know, shoot, what's the word?
Camouflage, Roland suggested.
Jake grinned. Camouflage, yeah. It's about the rose, not the building. And they can't get at it until they own the ground it grows on, I'm sure of it.
You may be right about the buildings not meaning anything, Susanna said, but that Turtle Bay name has a certain resonance, wouldn't you say?
She looked at the gunslinger. That part of Manhattan is called Turtle Bay, Roland.
He nodded, unsurprised. The turtle was one of the 12 guardians, and almost certainly stood at the far end of the beam upon which they now traveled.
The people from Mills Construction might not know about the rose, Jake said, but I bet the ones from Sombra Corporation do.
His hand stole into Oi's fur, which was thick enough at the Billy Bumbler's neck to make his fingers disappear entirely.
I think that somewhere in New York City, in some business building, probably in Turtle Bay on the east side, there's a door marked Sombra Corporation, and someplace behind that door, there's another door, the kind that takes you here.
For a minute, they sat thinking about it, about worlds spinning on a single axle in dying harmony, and no one said anything. 4.
Here's what I think is happening, Eddie said. Suze, Jake, feel free to step in if you think I'm getting it wrong. This guy, Cal Towers, some sort of custodian for the Rose. He may not know it on a conscious level, but he must be. Him and maybe his whole family before him. It explains the name.
Only he's the last, Jake said.
You can't be sure of that, hon, Susanna said. No wedding ring, Jake responded.
And Susanna nodded, giving him that one at least provisionally.
Maybe at one time there were lots of Taurens owning lots of New York property, Eddie said, but those days are gone. Now the only thing standing between the Sombra Corporation and the Rose is one nearly broke fat guy who changed his name. He's a, what do you call someone who loves books?
A bibliophile, Susanna said.
Yeah, one of those. And George Biondi may not be Einstein, but he said at least one smart thing while we were eavesdropping. He said Tower's place wasn't a real shop, but just a hole you poured money into. What's going on with him is a pretty old story where we come from, Roland. When my ma used to see some rich guy on TV, Donald Trump, for instance.
Who? Susanna asked.
You don't know him. He would have been just a kid back in 64, and it doesn't matter. Shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations, my mother would tell us. It's the American way, boys. So here's Tower, and he's sort of like Roland, the last of his line. He sells off a piece of property here and a piece there, making his taxes, making his house payments, keeping up with the credit cards and the doctor bills, paying for his stock, and yeah, I'm making this up, except somehow it doesn't feel that way.
No, Jake said. He spoke in a low, fascinated voice. It doesn't.
Perhaps you shared his kef, Roland said. More likely, you touched him. As my old friend Alain used to. Go on, Eddie.
And every year he tells himself the bookstore'll turn around, catch on, maybe, the way things in New York sometimes do. Get out of the red and into the black, and then he'll be okay. And finally, there's only one thing left to sell, lot 298 on block 19 in Turtle Bay.
298 adds up to 19, Susanna said. I wish I could decide if that means something or if it's just blue car syndrome.
What's blue car syndrome? Jake asked.
When you buy a blue car, you see blue cars everywhere.
Not here you don't, Jake said.
Not here,
Oi put in, and they all looked at him. Days, sometimes whole weeks, would go by, and Oi would do nothing but give out the occasional echo of their talk. Then he would say something that might almost have been the product of original thought. But you didn't know, not for sure. Not even Jake knew for sure. The way we don't know for sure about 19, Susanna thought, and gave the bumbler a pat on the head. Oi responded with a companionable wink.
He holds on to that lot until the bitter end, Eddie said. I mean, hey, he doesn't even own the crappy building his bookstores, and he only leases it.
Jake took over.
Tom and Jerry's artistic deli goes out of business, and Tower has it torn down, because part of him wants to sell the lot. That part of him says he'd be crazy not to.
Jake fell silent for a moment, thinking about how some thoughts came in the middle of the night, crazy thoughts, crazy ideas, and voices that wouldn't shut up. But there's another part of him, another voice.
The voice of the turtle, Susanna put in quietly.
Yes, the turtle or the beam, Jake agreed. They're probably the same thing, and this voice tells him he has to hold on to it at all costs.
He looked at Eddie. Do you think he knows about the rose? Do you think he goes down there sometimes and looks at it?
Does a rabbit shit in the woods? Eddie responded.
Sure he goes, and sure he knows. On some level he must know, because a corner lot in Manhattan, how much would a thing like that be worth, Susanna?
In my time, probably $1 million, she said. By 1977, God knows, 3, 5?
She shrugged. Enough to let Cy Tower go on selling books at a loss for the rest of his life, provided he was reasonably careful about how he invested the principal.
Eddie said, everything about this points up how reluctant he is to sell. I mean, Sue's already pointed out how little Sombra got for their $100,000.
But they did get something, Roland said. Something very important.
A foot in the door, Eddie said.
You say true. And now, as the term of their agreement winds down, they send your world's version of the big coffin hunters, hard caliber boys. If greed or necessity doesn't compel Tower to sell them the land with the rose on it, they'll terrify him into it.
Yeah, Jake said.
And who would stand on Tower's side?
Maybe Aaron Deepnoe? Maybe no one.
So what do we do?
Buy it ourselves, Susanna said promptly.
Of course. 5. There was a moment of thunderstruck silence, and then Eddie nodded thoughtfully.
Sure. Why not?
The Sombra Corporation doesn't have a topping privilege in their little agreement. They probably tried, but Tower wouldn't go for it. So sure, we'll buy it. How many deerskins do you think he'll want? 40? 50? If he's a real hard bargainer, maybe we can throw in some relics from the old people. You know, cups and plates and arrowheads. They'd be conversation pieces at cocktail parties. Susanna was looking at him reproachfully.
Okay, maybe not so funny, Eddie said.
But we have to face the facts, son. We're nothing but a bunch of dirty-ass pilgrims, currently camped out in some other reality. I mean, this isn't even mid-world anymore.
Also, Jake said apologetically, we weren't even really there. At least, not the way you are when you go through one of the doors. They sensed us, but basically we were invisible.
Let's take one thing at a time, Susanna said. As far as money goes, I have plenty. If we could get at it, that is.
How much? Jake asked. I know that's sort of impolite. My mother'd faint if she heard me ask someone that, but
we've come a little bit too far to worry about being polite, Susanna said.
Truth is, honey, I don't exactly know. My dad invented a couple of new dental processes that had to do with capping teeth, and he made the most of it. Started a company called Holmes Dental Industries and handled the financial side mostly by himself until 1959.
The year Mort pushed you in front of the subway train, Eddie said.
She nodded. That happened in August. About 6 weeks later, my father had a heart attack, the first of many. Some of it was probably stress over what happened to me, but I won't own all of it. He was a hard driver, pure and simple.
You don't have to own any of it, Eddie said. I mean, it's not as if you jumped in front of that subway car, Suze.
I know, but how you feel and how long you feel it doesn't always have a lot to do with objective truth. With Mama gone, it was my job to take care of him, and I couldn't handle it. I could never completely get the idea that it was my fault out of my head.
Gone days, Roland said, and without much sympathy.
Thanks, Shug, Susanna said dryly. You have such a way of putting things in perspective. In any case, my dad turned over the financial side of the company to his accountant after that first heart attack, an old friend named Moses Carver. After my dad passed, Pop Mose took care of things for me. I'd guess that when Roland yanked me out of New York and into this charming piece of nowhere, I might have been worth $8 or $10 million. Would that be enough to buy Mr. Tower's lot, always assuming he'd sell it to us?
He probably would sell it for deerskins, if Eddie's right about the beam, Roland said. I believe a deep part of Mr. Tower's mind and spirit, the car that made him hold on to the lot for so long in the first place, has been waiting for us.
Waiting for the cavalry, Eddie said, with a trace of a grin, like Fort Ord in the last 10 minutes of a John Wayne movie.
Roland looked at him, unsmiling. He's been waiting for the white.
Susanna held her brown hands up to her brown face and looked at them. Then I guess he isn't waiting for me, she said.
Yes, Roland said, he is,
and wondered briefly what color that other one was.
Mia.
We need a door, Jake said.
We need at least two, Eddie said. One to deal with Tower, sure, but before we can do that, we need one to go back to Susanna's when, and I mean as close to when Roland took her as we can possibly get. It'd be a bummer to go back to 1977, get in touch with this guy Carver, and discover he had Odetta Holmes declared legally dead in 1971, that the whole estate had been turned over to relatives in Green Bay or San Berdu.
Or to go back to 1968 and discover Mr. Carver was gone, Jake said. Funneled everything into his own accounts and retired to the Costa del Sol.
Susanna was looking at him with a shocked, oh my lands, expression that would have been funny under other circumstances.
Pop Mose would never do such a thing. Why, he's my godfather.
Jake looked embarrassed.
Sorry. I read lots of mystery novels. Agatha Christie, Rex Stout, Ed McBain, and stuff like that happens in them all the time. Besides, Eddie said, big money can do weird things to people.
She gave him a cold and considering glance that looked strange, almost alien on her face. Roland, who knew something Eddie and Jake didn't, thought it a frog-squeezing look.
How would you know? She asked. And then almost at once, oh, sugar, I'm sorry. That was uncalled for. It's okay, Eddie said. He smiled. The smile looked stiff and unsure of itself. Heat of the moment. He reached out, took her hand, squeezed it. She squeezed back. The smile on Eddie's face grew a little, started to look as if it belonged there.
It's just that I know Moses Carver. He's as honest as the day is long.
Eddie raised his hand, not signaling belief so much as an unwillingness to go any further down that path.
Let me see if I understand your idea, Roland said. First, it depends upon our ability to go back to your world of New York at not just one point of when, but two.
There was a pause while they parsed that. And then Eddie nodded. Right, 1964, to start with. Susanna's been gone a couple of months, but nobody's given up hope or anything like that. She strolls in, everybody claps. Return of the prodigal daughter. We get the dough, which might take a little time.
The hard part's apt to be getting Pop Mose to let go of it, Susanna said. When it comes to money in the bank, that man got a tight grip. And I'm pretty sure that in his heart he still sees me as 8 years old.
But legally it's yours, right? Eddie asked.
Roland could see that he was still proceeding with some caution. Hadn't quite got over that crack, how would you know, just yet. And the look that had gone with it.
I mean, he can't stop you from taking it, can he?
No, honey, she said. My dad and Pop Mose made me a trust fund, but it went moot in 1959 when I turned 25.
She turned her eyes, dark eyes of amazing beauty and expression, upon him.
There. You don't need to devil me about my age anymore, do you? If you can subtract, you can figure it out for yourself.
It doesn't matter, Eddie said. Time is a face on the water.
Roland felt goose flesh run up his arms. Somewhere, perhaps in a glaring, blood-colored field of roses still far from here, a Rusty had just walked over his grave. 6.
Has to be cash, Jake said in a dry, business-like tone.
Huh?
Eddie looked away from Susanna with an effort. Cash, Jake repeated. No one would honor a check, even a cashier's check, that was 13 years old. Especially not one for millions of dollars.
How do you know stuff like that, Shug?
Susanna asked. Jake shrugged. Like it or not, usually he didn't, he was Elmer Chambers' son. Elmer Chambers wasn't one of the world's good guys. Roland would never call him part of the white. But he had been a master of what network execs called the kill. A big coffin hunter in TV land, Jake thought. Maybe that was a little unfair, but saying that Elmer Chambers knew how to play the angles was definitely not unfair. And yeah, he was Jake, son of Elmer. He hadn't forgotten the face of his father, although he had times when he wished that wasn't so.
Cash, by all means, cash, Eddie said, breaking the silence. A deal like this has to be cash. If there's a check, we cash it in 1964, not 1977. Stick it in a gym bag. Did they have gym bags in 1964, Suze? Never mind, doesn't matter. We stick it in a bag and take it to 1977. Doesn't have to be the same day Jake bought Charlie the Choo-Choo and Riddledy Dum, but it ought to be close.
And it can't be after July 15th of 77, Jake put in.
God, no. Eddie agreed. We'd be all too likely to find Balazard persuaded Tower to sell, and there we'd be, bag of cash in one hand, thumbs up our asses, and big grins on our faces to pass the time of day.
There was a moment of silence. Perhaps they were considering this lurid image. And then Roland said, "You make it sound very easy, and why not? To you three, the concept of doorways between this world and your world of taxis and Aston and photographs seems almost as mundane as riding a mule would to me, or strapping on a six-gun. And there's good reason for you to feel that way. Each of you has been through one of these doors. Eddie has actually gone both ways, into this world and then back into his own."
"I gotta tell you that the return trip to New York wasn't much fun," Eddie said. "Too much gunplay.
Not to mention my brother's severed head rolling across the floor of Balazar's office."
"Neither was getting through the door on Dutch Hill," Jake added.
Roland nodded, ceding these points without yielding his own. "All my life I've accepted what you said the first time I knew you, Jake. What you said when you were dying." Jake looked down, pale and without answer. He did not like to recall that. It was mercifully hazy in any case, and knew that Roland didn't either.
Good, he thought. You shouldn't want to remember. You let me drop. You let me die.
You said there were other worlds than these, Roland said, and there are. New York, in all its multiple wens, is only one of many. That we are drawn there again and again has to do with the rose. I have no doubt of that. Nor do I doubt that in some way I do not understand the rose is the Dark Tower. Either that or...
Or it's another door, Susanna murmured. One that opens on the Dark Tower itself.
Roland nodded. The idea has done more than cross my mind. In any case, the many know of these other worlds, and in some fashion have dedicated their lives to them. They believe Todash to be the holiest of rites and most exalted of states. My father and his friends have long known of the glass balls, this I've told you. That the wizard's rainbow, Todash, and these magical doors may all be much the same is something we have guessed.
Where are you going with this, Shug? Susanna asked.
I'm simply reminding you that I have wandered long, Roland said, because of changes in time, a softening of time which I know you all have felt. I've quested after the Dark Tower for over 1,000 years, sometimes skipping over whole generations the way a seabird may cruise from one wave top to the next, only wetting its feet in the foam. Never in all this time did I come across one of these doors between the worlds until I came to the ones on the beach at the edge of the Western Sea. I had no idea what they were, although I could have told you something of Todash and the Bends of the Rainbow. Roland looked at them earnestly. You speak as though my world were as filled with magical doorways as yours is with... He thought about it. With airplanes or stage buses. That's not so.
Where we are now isn't the same as anywhere you've been before, Roland, Susanna said. She touched his deeply tanned wrist, her fingers gentle. We're not in your world anymore. You said so yourself back in that version of Topeka where Blaine finally blew his top.
Agreed, Roland said. I only want you to realize that such doors may be far more rare than you realize. And now you're speaking not of one but two doors you can aim in time the way you'd aim a gun.
I do not aim with my hand, Eddie thought, and shivered a little. When you put it that way, Roland, it does sound a little iffy. Then what do we do next? Jake asked.
I might be able to help you with that, a voice said.
They all turned, only Roland without surprise. He had heard the stranger when he arrived, about halfway through their palaver. Roland did turn with interest, however, and one look at the man standing 20 feet from them on the edge of the road was enough to tell him that the newcomer was either from the world of his new friends or from one right next door.
Who are you? Eddie asked. Where are your friends? Susanna asked. Where are you from? Jake asked.
His eyes were alight with eagerness. The stranger wore a long black coat, open over a dark shirt with a notched collar. His hair was long and white, sticking up on the sides and in front as if scared. His forehead was marked with a T-shaped scar.
My friends are still back there a little piece, he said, and jerked a thumb over his shoulder at the woods in a deliberately nonspecific way. I now call Calla Brinsturgis my home. Before that, Detroit, Michigan, where I worked in a homeless shelter making soup and running AA meetings. Work I knew quite well. Before that, for a short while, Topeka, Kansas.
He observed the way the three younger ones started at that with a kind of interested amusement.
Before that, New York City. And before that, a little town called Jerusalem's Lot, in the state of Maine.
7.
You're from our side, Eddie said. He spoke in a kind of sigh. Holy God, you're really from our side.
Yes, I think I am, the man in the turned-around collar said. My name is Donald Callahan.
You're a priest, Susanna said.
She looked from the cross that hung around his neck, small and discreet but gleaming gold, to the larger, cruder one that scarred his forehead.
Callahan shook his head. No more. Once. Perhaps one day again, with the blessing, but not now. Now I'm just a man.